Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Bush makes another visit to the Gulf region today as relief pours into that area, but calls for relief officials to be fired are also heard. We'll have more from the Gulf later. But first, before he left for the region, the president announced his pick to replace the late Supreme Court Justice William Rehnquist, who died over the weekend. The president's pick, John Roberts, who had originally been tapped to replace retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Joining us now, Professor Jonathan Turley from the George Washington University Law School. And Jonathan, first of all, your reaction to the announcement from the president. Did he catch you off guard?
He really did not. This decision makes abundant sense for a number of reasons. The most important one is simply the age of John Roberts. This is someone who will be Chief Justice for perhaps 30 years, maybe even more.
And as you said to us before, an excellent nominee for what President Bush is looking for.
Oh, I think that he is an excellent nominee for a number of reasons. One is he's extremely intelligent, extremely well-qualified. He is also profoundly conservative. And in fact, in some ways, he has identical views to Bob Bork. He's just simply more photogenic and has a better demeanor. And so what you're going to have in this Chief Justice is someone who will remain a hard right Chief Justice, even if the court in the country shifts to the left.
Well, you say what you're going to have. Do you think that it's going to be a tougher road for nominee Roberts as he's nominated for Chief Justice as it would have been for Justice?
In some ways, it might even be easier for John Roberts because he will now be replacing another hard right conservative. So it would look like a swap of one for one. And in that way, it could reduce some of the political issues. But at the end of the day, the Democratic Senate is in complete disarray. I mean, they have been in virtual chaos for literally months over these nominations. And they're just not ready for a fight. You have this remarkable disconnect where you have Democratic voters and groups spoiling for a fight and Democratic senators that are quietly trying to throw in the towel on this.
Well, I was going to ask, is this office seen as more important? In other words, will the fight ratchet up?
I don't know if the fight will ratchet up because of the political advantage of using a conservative to replace a conservative. It does make the nomination of the replacement of O'Connor, the ultimate swing vote on the court, that much more tense. Now, the fascinating possibility will be if Bush is doing this in some ways to help his friend Alberto Gonzalez. It would have been hard to appoint Alberto Gonzalez Chief Justice to replace a conservative with regard to the president's base. It would be a little easier if he were to replace O'Connor. He could sell it to Democrats as someone who's not as hard right as John Roberts, and he could sell it to his base as saying, look, I gave you an ultra-conservative Chief Justice.
And remind us, why is this so important? What does the Chief Justice do? I mean, everyone gets to vote.
When the Supreme Court votes, whatever side the Chief Justice is on, he can either write the opinion or decide who would write the opinion. So that means that the Chief Justice is always in the position to assign at least one of the opinions in a case if it's a divided opinion. But, you know, the Chief Justice also has one other significant role, and that is he is indeed the most visible, person of the Supreme Court. He, in some ways, can determine what the character of the court is. One thing is missing that people fail to understand about William Rehnquist is that liberals, of course, just demonize the man and hate the guy because he rolled back on the Warren Court cases. But what's fascinating is on the court itself, justices actually would speak very highly of Rehnquist. He was viewed as an honest broker. When he was in conference and in his decisions, he really didn't play the role of an ideologue. One of the concerns is whether John Roberts might have a little more of an edge in using his powers, not that he could make a huge difference. But in favor of John Roberts, he has a reputation of being a friendly, witty, and open type of individual. I happen to think he would make, in terms of his personality, a good Chief Justice.
And in pointing out what the Chief Justice does, you remind us another reason this announcement might have been made now. Without a Chief Justice in place, as Rehnquist passes over the weekend, their liberal Justice John Paul Stevens would have been the court's senior judge and would have been making the decisions, correct?
Yeah, And that would have been a perfect nightmare for conservatives. If they woke up and found John Paul Stevens as the acting Chief Justice, there would be people throwing themselves off the Memorial Bridge. And so there was no question that their priority was to get someone in there.
Professor Jonathan Turley teaches law at the George Washington University School of Law. Jonathan, thanks as always.
It's my pleasure.
Former Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton announced today that Walmart is kicking off their joint Hurricane Katrina fundraising effort with a donation of $23 million, $15 million from the giant chain, $8 million from the Walton family. Walmart also announced today that displaced Walmart workers from the Gulf will be given jobs in stores in other states. While Walmart will no doubt be applauded for its generosity today, its critics are not likely to back down. On this Labor Day, we have a unique look at the giant box store, how it's viewed by progressive businesses. Walmart is the largest private employer in the U.S. with a workforce of 1 million workers. Labor activists claim that Walmart workers have been locked in the store to prevent theft, forced to work off the clock, and encouraged to apply for welfare to supplement meager benefits. Well, Walmart is not the kind of company you'd associate with the Social Venture Network. But when SVN, an organization of socially responsible business people, recently gathered for an annual retreat, one of the topics on their schedule was what to do about Walmart, and the answer is complicated.
Is the end game get rid of Walmart, or is the end game the greenest, most socially responsible Walmart possible? There seems to be very, very little consensus about even that basic thought, that basic goal.
There are many different goals in the socially responsible business community when it comes to Walmart. Some want to change the company from within, some want to shut it down. Environmentalists, for instance, say Walmart contributes to sprawl and depletes resources by shipping goods around the world. But some environmentally conscious companies worry that if they boycott Walmart, they become elitist. The previous evening, Gary Hirschberg of Stonyfield Farm said his goal was to get organic food to the masses, and that's why he decided to sell his yogurt at Walmart. And Jennifer Chapman's company, the nonviolent interactive toy company Wild Planet, made the same decision.
Tell me again your thoughts from being asked to come to speak to this group. It's not a fun assignment.
I think that I was more acutely aware than I usually am of the paradoxical nature of some of the business choices we made. And that said, given the philosophy of our company, and our goal of reaching as many children in a variety of income brackets, that we've made the right decision for us, which I know isn't the right decision for many people in this group.
I've heard the owner of your company, Dan, speak to the fact that he didn't want the toys sold to just an upscale group of people in tiny toy stores. You're nodding yes.
Exactly.
But then there are all the other environmental and labor and all those considerations.
And there is no question about that. And we look to this group for inspiration and challenge, and that's exactly what we get.
There's nothing good about Walmart. Every time Walmart's built, entrepreneurs go out of business.
Advocates for local economies see Walmart as the biggest of the chain stores threatening small local businesses. But one political activist remembered calling a top Costco executive to ask for help in a voter drive.
And he literally turned on his whole staff to jump into this project, to engage everyone in making sure that every single one of his employees was able to get out to vote. And that was amazing.
And labor activists have their own message.
But I do want to raise one thought on whether to sell to Walmart or not, which is this is a vindictive company. Sheryl Crow released a CD with a song that had lyrics about Walmart, and they no longer sell her CDs. So I think that while I can understand the importance of marketing billboard products, if you will, they are buying your silence, too. Because I would guess that once you market at Walmart and you raise your voice against one of their practices, you will no longer be sold at Walmart.
That last comment was directed to Jeffrey Hollander of Seventh Generation, a company that produces recycled and environmentally friendly household products. He told this gathering he was looking to open dialogue with Walmart.
How would you characterize your company's relationship with Walmart?
Difficult question. I think we are a concerned observer of the impact they're having on the world. We're not unwilling to be engaged. I'm happy to speak with them. And yet we have some, I would say, grave concerns about whether us profiting from a relationship with them and them profiting from a relationship with us is in fact in keeping with the values and mission of our company.
You've expressed concerns about the low wages they pay to employees, the way they treat women. But if Walmart, and the question was asked here, if Walmart was a perfect company on those levels, would you then sell your products there? I mean, what about the fact of its size?
Yeah. Well, we aspire to grow ourselves. We want to grow so that we can have more of a positive impact. The question, I think, is what is a responsible business and how responsible is a responsible enough? One of my big problems with Walmart is the fundamental lack of transparency around what they're doing. So how can I make a decision about whether they're good or they're bad? If they won't tell me where they're making their products in China and under what conditions, how can I even form an opinion?
Does Costco do that because you sell to Costco and Target?
Yeah, I think Costco is much less of a large private label seller. Walmart sells a huge amount of products under its own brand. But this question of transparency is a very difficult question. I mean, we believe that every company should file a corporate responsibility report according to the GRI, Global Reporting Initiative's principles. To me, that should be the price of admission to the game. If you're not willing to provide that level of information, you shouldn't be allowed to be in business.
Walmart asked you to sell your products there. You politely said no, but how do you engage with them?
You know, I, as I said, I wrote to Lee Scott, and I said I would be happy and enjoy having a dialogue with you. And you know, we don't want to stand outside the store with signs yelling and screaming. Sometimes that's necessary, but we do believe in dialogue and we do believe in engagement. And, you know, our hope is that as we help ourselves to become better as a company, we can also help other businesses to become better. You know, we want to grow because we want to spread our message, where we ask questions, where we educate people, where we raise issues. So, you know, I don't want to say we'll never sell to Walmart, but today there is not the basis of information that we would need. Unfortunately, what we know about their labor practices and their environmental impact tells us that there is good reason not to sell to them. There may be another side to the story, but unless they talk to us, we won't know what it is.
Watch your sister, watch your brother, watch your children while they kill each other with a gun they bought at Walmart discount stores. Welcome to the hallway, metal detector just been installed. It isn't cops and robbers getting to be a big boy. Mary, Mary, quack and Terry, close your door now.
That was Jeff Hollander of 7th Generation Recycled Products speaking at a meeting of SVN, or Social Venture Network for Socially Responsible Business People. And this Sheryl Crow song that you're listening to is called Love is a Good Thing. It's the song that was banned by Walmart in 1996. Well, when we come back, Maverick labor leader Andy Stern on Walmart, and later news from New Orleans, where Walmarts were stripped of their guns by looters in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Much more to come here and now. News from New Orleans. But first, on this Labor Day, we've been looking at Walmart. And when it comes to the giant anti-union box store chain, union leaders, such as Andy Stern, president of the Service Employees International Union, have their work cut out for them. We caught up with Stern at the recent gathering of SVN, that's an organization for socially responsible business leaders, where he was a guest speaker. As we just heard, SVN's members are not all united in their opinion of what to do about Walmart. And many American consumers say they don't care about labor practices, they just care about price.
Victoria's Secret, well, their stuff's real nice. Oh, but I can buy the same damn thing on a Walmart shelf half price and still look sexy, just as sexy as those models on TV.
How do you approach this, given that you have, listening to a talk show, I heard a woman call and say, I feel so bad I don't have a Walmart near me. She loves the Walmart because she perceives it as an ally. You have Gretchen Wilson singing Victoria's Secret clothing is nice. I can get it at Walmart for half price. How do you confront that thinking?
You have to give Walmart credit for the low prices that come as a result of its technological efficiency and its innovation. But the truth is there are real cost to the low prices, real cost in terms of workers who don't make decent wages to be able to raise their family, workers who don't have health insurance or have their health insurance paid by taxpayers' dollars.
Because many of Walmart's workers take Medicaid.
Yeah, I mean, Walmart workers make so little money that in states like Georgia, 10,000 of them are actually having taxpayers pay for their health care instead of their employer. And Walmart has real costs in terms of lowering the wages of many workers in a community when they come in because they're paying less, and other employers say, well, I should pay less as well. And so there are real costs to the low prices.
And yet, you know, there are a lot of people who are against Walmart, but they come from all different agendas. How do you address those different agendas? What's your end game? What's your goal?
I mean, our goal is to make the world's leading company lead in terms of being the company that provides good wages and benefits. Our end game is to have Walmart be a successful company, but a leader, and not just someone that's lowering the standards all around the world.
What do you say to the people who might support you, but they're saying, we don't want any Walmart? Now, when you lead a union that could benefit from good Walmarts that had good unions, because a lot of workers would have good jobs and good wages, what do you say to people who say, I don't want any Walmarts?
I think this is a situation where every community has to decide the benefits of having a Walmart. I don't think we can make a blanket decision. I think this has to be a decision made community by community.
Broadening out to just labor in general, what do you say to Americans who really believe that unions are part of the problem in the economy? They believe that unions are driving costs up and are the reason that jobs are having to go overseas.
I'd say recently the tide has turned and more people appreciate that now we have jobs going overseas that are white-collar, high-tech jobs in all kinds of non-union industries, and that what I think people are saying is, boy, I wish we could get back to the days that I could get a union job, you know, the one with benefits and the one I could raise a family. And so I think the tide's turned in terms of people appreciating the role that unions played about creating a middle class.
But why aren't more people joining unions? 33%, I think, 50 years ago of workers were unionized. Now I think it's 1 in 10, 1 in 12. Why?
Well, when you have companies like Walmart who close down stores when people exercise their right to want to have their own organization, when you have employers spending millions of dollars hiring consultants, having people hold captive audience meetings, I mean, workers aren't willing to take the risk with this kind of pressure. And it's unbelievable that in a democracy like ours, that we practice the kind of policies that we reject in China in terms of how we give our workers no real choice anymore about whether they want to have their own organization.
How much is the labor movement responsible for what appears to be the lack of appeal of a union?
Well, I think the labor movement has a responsibility that we haven't spent the resources we need to grow stronger. We are not out talking to enough not yet union workers every day. And I'm hopeful in the end we're going to do what's right for workers, which is to build a modern, new, dynamic, growing labor movement.
It's a big fight in the labor movement right now. What's wrong? What's missing? What do you want?
What's missing is that we're disorganized labor. We're divided. 92% of people aren't in unions. We're divided 15 different unions in construction, 12 in transportation.
Tell me how that division affects negotiations, affects the movement.
Because people are not coordinating and cooperating. And so we have, in some ways, you know, unions in the airline industry. One union makes a cut, and then another company comes forward and says, well, if that company's going to pay less, we have to pay less as well. We don't have a united strategy. We have too many workers in too many different kinds of unions. It makes it very hard to have a responsible relationship with our employers.
You've actually said that you have some sympathy for employers and companies who may have to negotiate with five different unions for one kind of worker.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very difficult for an employer, you know, to have multiple unions who are making different demands about pensions and health care. Certainly you can go on a construction site and see 15 different craft unions, each of them, you know, with their own contract and their own way of doing business. And the fact that we can't coordinate or cooperate when we have five unions leads me to believe that unless workers get a choice to vote, to be in bigger and stronger unions, to vote for mergers, that nothing is really going to ever change.
We hear as well that you're open to sort of a lesser than a union member kind of status for workers. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think in this world today where there's so many consultants and contingent workers, and we just can't have a one-size-fits-all. And so, for instance, we have an internet union called Purple Ocean. There are other unions that have been organized for writers to make sure that people get, you know, a fair pay for their freelance work, that make sure that if they want to have benefits and get money from their employer, they can buy them economically. I mean, there's lots of roles that unions can play about training, about portability of benefits, that I think are enormously important in today's economy.
Walmart has worked to not only keep unions out, but not even hire the kind of people who might want to join a union. A campaign to get consumers not to shop at Walmart really hasn't worked. What's left?
I think there's a huge period of education. I think Walmart is a very low-cost provider. But people, when they hear are what the real costs are to get those low prices, whether it's for workers down the street, whether it's for small businesses in their community, are beginning to wonder, why does the largest employer, where five members of the family have $20 billion each, need, you know, to treat their community so badly? And we're hoping that Walmart someday will enter into a discussion about how we can make the world's leading company really be a leader in this economy.
That's Andy Stern, president of the Service Employees International Union. You're listening to Here and Now. Bush is in Louisiana again today, where officials estimate the death toll will be in the thousands, rivaling the loss of life from the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Nearly 500,000 people have been evacuated from New Orleans, and the military believes there are only 10,000 left in the city. The Red Cross has set up 470 shelters in 15 states that are currently housing 125,000 people. And Zach Abraham of the Red Cross says those shelters will stay up indefinitely.
Our operation is still undetermined. I mean, we're going to continue to provide services for people as long as there's a need. And so this could go into months, depending on how long it takes to get these people back on their feet.
Meantime, residents of Jefferson Parish, just west of New Orleans, are being allowed temporarily back into their homes today to see what's left. This comes a day after the president of that parish broke down on national television. Aaron Broussard, speaking on NBC's Meet the Press, said someone should be held accountable for the people who've died. And he told the story of a coworker whose mother was trapped in a nursing home waiting for a rescue that never came.
She called him and said, "Are you coming, son? Is somebody coming?" And she said, "Yeah, Mama, somebody's coming to get you." And she drowned Friday night.
That woman began her calls on Tuesday and, as he said, drowned on Friday night. Just one of hundreds of stories of people lost in the aftermath of Katrina. Well, joining us on the line now, Patrick Johnson of the Christian Science Monitor. Patrick, I understand you were in the city yesterday and are trying to get back in today, but are stuck in a traffic jam.
Yeah, we got quite a traffic jam coming out of Baton Rouge and into New Orleans. We're on 61, but I think I-10 is also backed up today. But understandably, people are very anxious, obviously, to get back and see what's left.
And they're just being allowed in now. Well, tell us, from what you've seen and heard, what is the focus of the relief operations right now?
I think it's starting to change. Yesterday, when I was in, there's a lot of people now who actually want to stay, even in some of the flooded neighborhoods. I was out with kind of a makeshift crew of rescuers yesterday, some locals who had stayed on and camped out near in the 17th Ward in the Holly Grove neighborhood, and a lot of the neighbors are staying. One rescuer said there were probably hundreds of people that he had seen who had declined to be helped, and even some who kind of hid from rescuers. You know, people go around tooting horns, trying to get people out of their houses, but some people are not even answering.
We understand a lot of these people are very elderly people who are afraid of losing what little they have. Do you think they understand that, you know, electricity and resources might not be back for weeks?
To be honest with you, I saw some people yesterday who probably know less about what's happening than folks in Sri Lanka right now. I mean, these folks probably have not had radios or anything like that. They've been stuck in the house for days and days, know very little about what the outside world knows.
What are police telling you? Are they going to try to forcibly remove these people?
No, not yet, at least. It is becoming an issue, though, because, you know, these rescuers are starting to backtrack. People are asking for more food when they clearly have food stockpiled already in their houses. So for rescue workers now, they're starting to deny some folks water and food if they know those folks already have. Of course, they're not going to deny people who need it, but several rescuers told me they had seen stockpiles of water in the houses, and some had said no, that they won't resupply them. And that's something I heard from Homeland Security spokesman yesterday, too, who acknowledged that that's the reality on the ground. It's becoming time-consuming now for some of those rescuers to feed a population that, you know, may seem inexplicable to some people, but they are determined to stay, at least for now.
Well, and what is the security like? There's still scattered reports of violence, we know. 14 contractors came under fire yesterday as they went to plug a breach on the 17th Street Canal. We understand police shot and killed about five people then. So what do you understand as the security now?
Well, yesterday when I was in, there was no issues at all where I was. But clearly I heard from folks in one parish where there had been looting, where some residents had armed themselves and basically threatened looters publicly on a radio program that they would not get out alive if they came to loot in their neighborhood. Clearly what happened yesterday on with the construction workers on near the bridge on the west side of the city was emblematic of that tension. I think overall, though, that security situation is pretty much in control at this point.
Well, today the Times-Picayune, the newspaper there that had written extensively prior to the hurricane about the possibility of just this event happening, they called for everyone in FEMA, the federal organization, to be fired in an open letter to President Bush. We're going to have more on calls for these kinds of firings in just a moment, but you traveled, as you said, with the rescue team yesterday. What are rescue workers saying about the relief efforts?
Well, I talked to one Louisiana Fish and Wildlife officer who was very well-versed. He knew just about everything that was going on in the city. He said this rescue operation was being done on a whim. But on the ground, that's what it feels like. It's a mishmash of rescue workers in New Orleans. You've got everything from Volvo. I've talked to some guys from Volvo in Houston who had come down. You've got people from Miami, and you've also got people like I met yesterday who are just residents who are commandeering boats to run their own rescue operations, which is all being welcomed by you know, official rescue workers. It's you know, they're just really trying to get the job done, and it hasn't been pretty.
Have you talked to or seen any FEMA people in New Orleans? And by the way, that wouldn't mean that they're not there, but I'm just wondering if you came across them.
Personally, I did not, but I did come. There were clearly, where I was yesterday, there were clearly people in command, and I think there might have been one or two FEMA people there, but I didn't speak to any directly. We were mostly law enforcement officers of various kinds. Well, I did see some National Guardsmen, and things were getting done. I want to be straight about that. When they needed medical help, they got it. When they needed choppers, they got it. Things were happening.
Well, Patrick, you know, on that note, I did want to make sure we mentioned that things are happening, and also there are incredibly heroic stories as well.
I would say so, yeah. The rescuers here are obviously under a lot of stress and have done incredible things. And again, it goes from just yesterday, they had to try to finagle a 400-pound, very frightened man out of a house, and I believe that was successful. But, you know, these people are using very small, flat-bottom boats oftentimes, airboats. You've got all kinds of stories, but clearly people are putting their lives on the line every day to rescue these people, which is part of the frustration, too, when people don't want to be rescued. It's a little confounding to some people, obviously.
And we want to note that although there are stories of upwards of 200 New Orleans police officers turning in their badges from the pressure, there's a core group that has stayed there. And, in fact, talk about the toll that it's taken, too. Committed suicide because of, you know, the desperation of the past week. Did you see New Orleans police officers? Or
I did not where I was, but granted, you know, parts of the city are just kind of abandoned right now. So it's, you know, where I was, it was kind of abandoned. It was near a levee, very, very flooded area. So there weren't many people around. Again, there's all manners of official folks. I mean, I think today they may have, I think they have about 17,000 National Guardsmen, but there's just thousands more rescue workers and official folks of all kinds, including, of course, New Orleans police and police from the nearby parishes.
Patrick Johnson of the Christian Science Monitor just outside New Orleans right now. Patrick, thanks for speaking with us.
Okay, Robin, thank you.
And we'll have more tomorrow on how you can help. But for information now on how you can aid the people devastated by Hurricane Katrina, you can go to our website, here-now.org, and click on How You Can Help. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, President Bush's father and former President Bill Clinton today announced a nationwide fundraising campaign to help the victims of Hurricane Katrina. During the press conference in Houston, President Clinton said there may be a need to set up a Katrina commission to investigate what went wrong in the aftermath of the hurricane. He also called on Congress to focus on helping the people of the Gulf region when it goes back into session tomorrow.
What I do think should be focused on now is what is the Congress going to do when they get back? How are we going to find jobs for these people? Where are they really going to live? Do they need some cash right away? Those are the things that I think should be done. I hope the Congress will defer the schedule that was before it, including the state tax issue and all that. I'd like to see it all deferred, and I'd like to see the needs of these folks face now.
Well, joining us on the line with the political ramifications of Hurricane Katrina, Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gail, do you think Congress will defer its schedule for tomorrow?
Well, you've already seen a bit of a shift due to the death of Chief Justice Rehnquist, so that the hearings that were supposed to be absolute top priority on Tuesday will shift probably till Thursday. But in terms of Republicans giving up the estate tax, they're still holding on to that yet. They're saying it's possible to do the business of the American people, of which the estate tax is one, and also deal with the hurricane relief. So you saw a lot of scrambling this weekend for committee chairmen to come up with immediate things that can be done through their committees along the lines that President Clinton just said to help people directly. But they do not want to give up the estate tax, and that looks like it's still going to come up this week.
Well, there's so much that they are hearing, these congressmen and women, as they go into this session. The federal response to the hurricane has drawn fierce criticism, as we've heard, and we just heard a little bit from the president of the Jefferson Parish, who broke down on Meet the Press. He also said that FEMA officials not only didn't have enough aid in the aftermath, but that they blocked aid. He claims that when Walmart sent trailers loaded with water, they were blocked by FEMA. They also turned away Coast Guard workers delivering fuel. Pretty damning accusations. Are heads going to roll on this?
Well, the president is very loyal to his people. It's very unusual to see any heads roll in his administration, but members of Congress are not. And they're coming back, even before the hurricane, very concerned about issues like Guantanamo, what's going on in Iraq. I think you will see no hesitancy on the part of this Congress to immediately answer the question who's responsible for what and why.
And what kind of political backplaying are you seeing? For instance, Louisiana, the state, has just hired James Witt, the former FEMA head who received bipartisan acclaim when he was in the Clinton administration. He's just been hired by Louisiana. It's seen as a slap in the face to Michael Brown, who is the current head of FEMA, who we are now reading had, well, his background when he was hired in 2001, he was the head of the Arabian Horsemen's Association.
Yeah, he's probably the most endangered person in Washington right now.
Whereas James Witt had 23 years of disaster relief work when he had the job.
Respected.
Yeah, do you think Michael Brown, I mean, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think you're going to see very quick investigations, even as the leadership, probably on both sides of the aisle, will express support for the president and follow his lead. There is sufficient and very deep maverick tendencies, even in the Republican Party, from members who realize they're going to have to face voters very soon, and they cannot look like they were sitting on their hands through this, which has been, you know, with each hour, more of a national shame.
Yeah. Gail Chadwick, with just a few seconds that we have, FEMA was absorbed by the Homeland Security Department in 2003. Now there are calls to make it a standalone agency again. What do you think is going to happen?
I think that's going to be looked at very closely. Were Democrats in control of this, the Congress, you would see hearings tomorrow. But the Republicans have a legacy to defend, and a big part of that was the Homeland Security Department and the reorganization. So I think there'll be some reluctance to jettison the whole thing. But in terms of targeting individuals, that you could see very quickly.
Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. of Gulf News, but first, on this Labor Day, a look at the issue of retirement. In recent times, many older Americans have chosen to work longer for fun and to take advantage of longer and healthier lives. But new research says Americans are now considering working past retirement for financial survival. We recently asked people here in Boston, do you think you're going to be able to retire?
I do. I don't know if I want to or will completely 100% retire. I'm sure I'll still do something, and I may have to kind of make ends meet.
I don't believe that I'll be able to retire because I do work that I love, but I am a social worker for a community mental health center, and it means I'll have to work longer. In fact, I think I'll probably work till I'm 80 or 85.
Do you think that you'll be able to ever retire?
I'm looking at it sometime, maybe in 25 years.
Not likely. I've just recently opened up a store, and I think I'm going to have to be working the rest of my life.
Well, joining us on the line is Carl Van Horn, director of the John J. Heldrich Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University. And Professor Van Horn, you just recently did a survey on Americans' attitudes about work. We just heard some voices about retirement. What did you find that was in your mind new about views of retirement?
Well, I think the traditional notion of retirement sitting back on your porch in a rocking chair and maybe playing golf or canasta or something like that is pretty obsolete today. And there are really two reasons for that. One of the folks said on the lead in there that they don't think they'll be able to retire. So that's part of it. There's a financial necessity as defined benefit pensions, which used to guarantee a pension income, have gone away. And as people are worried about their 401k, their savings, there are lots of folks that say they have to work.
It's sort of that idea of the hammock and the lemonade. Has, as you said, been fading for a while now, as people live longer lives. But if I'm reading your results right, it indicates that even people who said they were going to work part-time just for personal interests has dropped sharply from 42% to 27%. So it seems like attitudes about retirement really are more about, financial security.
That's right. We took a snapshot in 2000, and that was right at the peak of the economic boom. Back then, people's 401ks were really fat, and they were beginning to believe that those 20% returns were going to continue forever, and they'd be retiring at age 45. Well, gravity has returned to the stock market and to people's sense of retirement. Now they realize that all that money that they thought was going to be there won't be there, and they're probably going to have to work just to, at least part-time, to help afford the lifestyle that they want to have.
Do the comparison for us. How many people are saying now that they are going to work longer because of financial needs?
Well, that number doubled. In 2000, it was about 1 in 10 workers, and now it's 2 in 10 workers.
Did they mention, for instance, the debate over Social Security or the private pensions that we've seen gone away in unions, for instance?
Yeah, absolutely. On the Social Security debate, a lot of Americans are very aware of it, and the main thing that they are aware of is that there's a problem, because both the Democrats and President Bush did a good job of convincing them there's a problem or a crisis, depending on which perspective you take. But it increased their anxiety, really, about whether Social Security is going to be there when they retire.
Well, you also found out a little bit about what this new thinking might mean, because you also surveyed people with their thoughts about age discrimination. What did you find about age discrimination?
Well, that's right. They are worried about age discrimination, and they're beginning to think that older workers are not treated fairly when the layoff comes, or in a hiring decision or in a promotion decision.
Well, and younger workers leerily looking at them and thinking, if you're going to have to work longer for financial reasons, you're going to take my job.
Absolutely. Younger workers are going to feel, and probably will, experience blocked opportunity.
So now we have the notion of older workers not only, looking askance at their bank accounts or their pension accounts, but looking over their shoulders.
That's right. Also, older workers told us that when you ask them what an older worker is, they say it's someone over the age of 50, but they think employers think an older worker is someone over the age of 40. So in other words, they're suspicious that they're being counted as an older worker 10 years before their time.
Well, and what does this tell us about how workers might adjust to what they see as the coming reality?
Well, it's interestingly, most of them will adjust, I think, by staying in the workplace longer. They're not going to save more, because although they tell us that they're doing a good job of it, they also admit more than a third of them don't save anything for retirement or can't afford to save anything for retirement. Whatever their current standard of living is,
they say, listen, we just don't have any money left over. And, of course, when you look at income and education, this is predominantly people at the low end of the income ladder and having less education. So the likelihood is that if they're working an hourly job or a couple or three part-time jobs, they probably don't have any disposable income, if you will, that they can set aside for retirement.
Well, Carl Van Horn, if you were a policymaker, what would you do with this information? He's not a policymaker, by the way. He's the director of the John J. Heldrich Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers. But if you were making policy, what would you take out of this study of yours?
Well, I think from the standpoint of the private sector firm, I mean, just to start there, I think they're going to have to reckon with this tsunami of change in the workforce. In other words, I don't think they really, in most companies, come to grips with the fact that people want to stay longer and work longer, and that's going to cause certain problems. Or, put differently, it creates an opportunity because older workers, many of them are very talented. They may not want to work full-time, but they'd like to have some continued engagement. That's a different policy than most companies have. Typically, they say, well, you have to be out by a certain age, and that's it, zero, no more work. On the public policy side, what we have here is we need to come up with ways to encourage people to save more when they can afford to. And clearly, with the rapid decline of guaranteed pension programs, which has been going on for the last 20 years, that means people are going to be more responsible themselves, and therefore the government's got to do more to give them the incentive to save.
Carl Van Horn is the director of the John J. Heldrich Center for Workforce Development. It's at Rutgers University. And Professor Van Horn, one last question. How long are you going to work?
I don't intend to retire because I love doing what I do, and I'm going to do it as long as I'm able and healthy.
Tell that to the 25-year-old down the hall.
Well, he or she would not like to hear that, but that's the truth.
Professor, thank you.
Okay.
And we have a few notes about today's top stories before we go. As we said earlier, the president has nominated Judge John Roberts to lead the Supreme Court. Roberts had been named to replace retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and the Senate was to begin considering that nomination tomorrow. Now, those hearings have been postponed. New hearings take place after Wednesday's funeral for the late Chief Justice William Rehnquist, and President Bush will get a chance to make another appointment to the High Court to replace O'Connor. As for the Gulf region, the president is making another appearance in the region struck by Hurricane Katrina. He went to the Bethany World Prayer Center in Baton Rouge, Louisiana today, where he praised the volunteers and churches who've taken care of evacuees. The president said all levels of government are doing the best they can. One evacuee was not fazed by the presidential appearance. Mildred Brown, who's been at the prayer center with her family since last Tuesday, said she was not interested in handshaking or photo opportunities. This, she said, is going to take a lot of money. Of course, we'll follow both the Roberts nomination and the wake left by Katrina in the coming days. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Manigan, Kevin Sullivan, Alex Ashlock, Tara Murphy, Emiko Tamagawa, Vince Fairchild, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugars is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. I hope you're having a restful Labor Day. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com. And by REMAX of New England, a source for real estate assistance in New England, featuring an online renovation guide, agent locator, and comprehensive property search. REMAX-NewEngland.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the new